The J Talk Podcast.
Yosh, 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 yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, J1 returned with a post-Olympics bang, with late drama and upsets up and down the country on Monday to help us put the disappointment of that bronze medal match behind us.
Yeah, it was a perfect way to come back. I thought it was a terrific round of fixtures, bar one game. It was, yeah, a lot of action, everything happening. It was just the J-League at its best and what we all needed, I think, after the events of Friday night.
Yes, indeed. So the Young Samurai took on Mexico for the bronze medal at Tokyo 2020 last Friday night. Sam, you mentioned on last week's episode that Japan had the blueprint for taking on the Mexicans after the fast start that they had made in the group stage clash. It's just unfortunate that Mexico nicked said blueprint and jumped all over Hajime Moriyasu's team from the off.
Yeah, it was absolutely roles reversed. Japan were very passive, a bit like the way Mexico were in that first game, and the Mexicans were right on top of them from the off, pressing them, causing errors, and Japan just did not really get going until the second half. It was a dreadful performance, I thought, for the majority of that game from Japan. They were just sitting off them, no attacking intent until Mitoma and Ueda came on in the second half, and it was just really poor. I mean, Endo, arguably the Japan's best player in this tournament, had an awful game. He lost his man from a couple of set pieces. He conceded the penalty. So, and that just kind of was like encapsulated Japan's performance. It was really disappointing, especially when, as you say, they have beaten Mexico already in this tournament and should have looked to have played in the same manner.
Yes, indeed. And, you're right about Endo. Such a terrific tournament from him. But then, at the last hurdle, unfortunately, well, especially in the first 20 minutes or so, he had a bit of a shocker, didn't he? He gave away the penalty early doors and then, lost his man at a set piece, and Japan were 2-0 down by the 22nd minute. Then just before the hour, Mexico made it 3-0 with another set piece header. We've spoken throughout the tournament at the lack of opportunities afforded to Kaoru Mitoma, Sam, either through fitness or Moriyasu just not putting his faith in him. We're not sure if it's what sort of a combination of both it is. As you say, only after he and ISA Ueda were belatedly summoned from the bench did Japan perk up, and Mitoma scored a brilliant goal with 12 minutes left. Who knew, eh?
Oh, yeah, unbelievable. who saw that we had one of the best, well, probably at least in the top three players in that squad that's just been left on the bench and barely being played. And he was just magnificent. He did what he's been doing for Kawasaki for the last 18 months. He just was the one player that would take the ball, take on his man, look to be direct and look to go forward. And he scored a terrific goal and could have had a couple more in the game. I just thought, so frustrating watching that last 30 minutes with Japan 3-0 down and just seeing what could have been if they had have played Mitoma a lot more. I not necessarily in the Spain game, where I don't have any problem with the game plan in that, but the games like against South Africa and against New Zealand, when it was crying out for a player like Mitoma, it was just, questions have to be asked of Moriyasu and why he has not played as much as he has. And I'd say the same with Ueda as well. He obviously didn't have quite as big an impact in the game as Mitoma did, but he's the one striker in the squad that will always look first and foremost to get a shot off on goal. And as well as Hayashi has played in terms of his hold-up play and maybe feeding Kubo and Doan, Ueda is the one player that will look to get a shot on goal and look to be positive. So, it's just really disappointing watching that 30 minutes that these two players, especially Mitoma, didn't get a lot more game time in the tournament. And, it's a worry for me going forward with Moriyasu if he is going to limit the amount of game time that players like Mitoma are going to get.
Indeed. And in that vein, we did have a question come in from one of our patrons, Nick. He actually sent it to me while the game was going on at, as he said, 3:30 a.m. in California. So it's huge commitment from Nick to be up watching that game. And then, obviously he shared our frustrations because he felt compelled to send a message through to us for us to discuss later on this episode. So, Nick basically said that he's curious now that we've seen two big tournaments from Hajime Moriyasu in charge, what we think about him as a national team manager. Nick says he wasn't too impressed with how conservative he had the team play in the Asian Cup, but thought that maybe things were turning a corner during some of the friendlies. But these knockout games in the Olympics, Nick concludes with a woof. And, yeah, well, obviously, we've spoken about it in the last couple of episodes, haven't we, Sam? And mostly linked to Mitoma, but also the struggles that Japan have had breaking down resolute opponents, as we saw South Africa in the opener and then the New Zealand in the quarterfinals. So, yeah, there is a lot of food for thought for Moriyasu, especially when you consider that, yeah, a number of the players in this Olympic squad are now well-established in the full national team setup as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think this Mexico game was the worst one. It's probably what's harboured the feelings, and especially after the, staying up at 3:30 a.m. to watch whatever this dross was. But yeah, I agree with him. Especially at the Asian Cup, I thought Japan were very poor. The problem that you'll have if you're trying to get rid of Moriyasu is, on paper, he's got to an Asian Cup final and he's lost to Spain in an Olympic semi-final. So that looks pretty decent. But the Asian Cup, every game except for the Iran game was just very passive, very negative, a lack of real cutting edge. But that Iran game in that semi-final, Japan were incredible with their pressing and the way that they beat a very tough Iranian side in that game. So that gave me hope going forward. And then in the meantime, we've had these qualifiers where Japan just win quite easily. And of course, they're going to look like a really good attacking team against some of the lesser nations in Asia. And then there's no real pressure in a friendly, so Japan can express themselves a little bit more. But once they've got to this tournament, the South Africa game wasn't negative, but it was a lacking of ideas, and the same really against New Zealand. But there were moments of hope. That Mexico game, especially the first half an hour, maybe even up to 60 minutes, was terrific from Japan, and against a weakened French team, but they were very good and very attacking in that game. So there are these moments that give you hope that a Moriyasu side can play in this progressive style and get the best out of the plethora of attacking options that Japan seem to have. But yeah, the last few games, yeah, it was just very negative. I understand it, as I said, against Spain, but this game especially, when you've been shown that playing on the front foot, aggressively attacking and pressing high was the way to beat Mexico, and just to sit back and play as passive as they were was really disappointing. So I hope that Moriyasu learns a lesson from this and takes that on into the qualifiers, where they're going to be against a lot of a higher standard of team than they've been playing so far in the qualifiers. So I will give him a little bit of time, but he needs to develop the way he's playing. And what about you, Ben? How have you seen his reign?
Well, yeah, I mean, he had pretty decent size boots to fill, didn't he, with Nishino doing so well at the last World Cup. But, yeah, I think the way that he's brought the younger players through does afford us some hope for the future. But, yeah, he's going to have to be a little bit more progressive with his ideas, I think. He's going to have to, really utilise the strengths of his attacking players, because we've seen it in bursts that, yeah, when they're on and when they're properly tuned in, then they can be terrific going forward. And, you know, that's what we want to see. We want to see the likes of Kubo and Doan get proper runs in the full national team with, Osako, Minamino, etc. Also fit and firing. So, yeah, as you say, the next round of World Cup qualifiers will be a huge test for Moriyasu. We would expect Japan to qualify, and obviously it's a massive failure if they don't. But yeah, we want to see a better football against better quality opponents along the way. And certainly you're entitled, and Nickers as well, to still have your doubts, especially after what could have been at Tokyo 2020 for the under-24s. And, I mean, well, you could see the disappointment and frustration amongst the players at the full-time whistle. I mean, if they didn't have to turn the lights out, Takefusa Kubo might still be there lying on the pitch crying. And at the end of the day, Sam, yeah, they've played two really good games out of six, and they've left with nothing as we wrap things up.
Yeah, they have, and it's a shame for all the players, but I don't think they deserved a medal based on the performances. You can't just turn up in two games, and whether that's the players or whether it's the managers there, philosophy and the way he set them up. It's probably a combination of both. I think in that New Zealand game, they had a lot of possession and the players didn't quite turn up as well as they could have done. I mean, they had enough of the ball and Kubo and Doan could have done more with it, even though it was against a tight defence. So I don't think Japan really can have any complaints about it. It is a shame to get so close and then miss out, but hopefully, it's a very young team, obviously, at the Olympics, they need to take this on board and learn from it in the future. And these qualifiers coming up pretty quickly, and a lot of this squad will be expecting or at least hoping to be in that senior national team, so they've got a very quick turnaround before they can kind of make amends for this.
Most definitely. All right, well said, Sam. And yeah, thanks for sending your question in, Nick. We hope you had a proper sleep in after staying up so late or getting up so early to watch Japan take on Mexico. But yeah, after that performance, I imagine you might have been tossing and turning for a few hours. But anyway, we really appreciate you getting in touch. And of course, it goes without saying, for your ongoing support on Patreon, mate. All right, so as we segue on to more action in the summer transfer window, Sam, Daichi Hayashi, who served as the main striker, I suppose, for Moriyasu in most of the games in the Olympics, of course. So ISA Waiter did start one or two games. But yeah, Hayashi was preferred for the most part as the main man up front. He has continued the exodus from Tosu, although I must say it certainly didn't hinder them in their league return against FC Tokyo on Monday night. Hayashi is the latest member not only out of Tosu, but into the Japanese contingent at Sint-Truiden, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, I think he deserves this move. I think he's played very well for last season and a half for Tosu, and then obviously was put on a pedestal at the Olympics. He was their main striker for Japan. What he did very well in terms of the way he would hold up the ball, how he would get the best out of Kubo and Doan behind him. So, I'm very happy for him to have got this move. He goes to Sint-Truiden, which is away from home for Japanese players in Europe. And it's been a place where players have moved. You think of Tomiyasu, Endo, Kamada have all started at Sint-Truiden and then moved on to bigger and better things in Europe. So I think it's a perfect little place for Hayashi to go to. He's going to probably replace Yuma Suzuki, who's having a bit of a standoff with Sint-Truiden at the moment, and he's looking to get a move away. So Hayashi should go in there. I've spoken a lot with the Belgian analyst over the last couple of days over various transfers, but it looks like Hayashi should fit in with the front two there, where I think that's probably his best role. He worked very well with Yamashita at Tosu for the last few months and the last season as well. And I think as a kind of like the supplier in a front two, I think he's very good. I don't expect him to go out and score a ton of goals, but I think he can work very well there. So yeah, it's a really good move for him. It's a shame for Tosu that it's another player that has been forced out. But yeah, I think it's impossible to stand in Hayashi's way. So yeah, good luck to him. And I think, yeah, his performances have earned this move.
Yes, indeed. Be very interesting to see how he gets on over there. And yes, another Olympic player to transfer is the previously mentioned Kaoru Toma. Neil Debnam's worst fears were confirmed when it was announced that, yes, Mitoma had signed for Brighton and will go out on loan to a Belgian first division team, USG, for this season, Sam. So, this was obviously long rumoured, and to have it confirmed, I guess, will be great news for Mitoma, and he looks to start his European adventure. But obviously a bittersweet moment for all Kawasaki fans to see another one of their favourites departing Todoroki.
Yeah, very much so, especially after Tanaka left as well. That's arguably their two best players they've lost in this summer window, which is, it's going to be really difficult for them to replace both of them. But, I mean, Mitoma, what can we say about him? The last 18 months since joining Kawasaki, he's been absolutely phenomenal, probably the best player in the league during that time, and it's great for him to be able to get a move. So eventually when he gets to Brighton, I think it'll be really exciting. Brighton are a team that like to play progressive football. I think he'll fit in there very well once he's allowed to play. But yeah, he's got this loan spell now just to get points up for a work permit. And I've still got my reservations about this team. They started well, USG in Belgium. They've top of the league after the first three games as a newly promoted side. And as I say, I've been speaking to the Belgian analyst at Football Radar, and he says they do play very progressive football. They like to attack. So it should, from a stylistic point of view, really help Mitoma. But they are kind of set in their ways at this 3-5-2 formation. And Mitoma as a left wing back, I think, would really hamper him in terms of going forward. And I don't really remember him defending a great deal during his time at Kawasaki. Yeah. And I could see him maybe playing in behind the striker. I think he did that a little bit at... for his university team and previously for like Japan's under 21s and whatnot. So maybe he kind of gets a free role in there, which, I mean, he could be very dangerous when given a bit of freedom in behind. So hopefully that works out well for him. I'm sure Brighton will be telling USG that you've got to play Mitoma, you've got to get minutes into his legs for when he joins Brighton. Obviously, there is their feeder team, so I think they've got a little bit of control over the way that USG are going to play. So hopefully it's not as bad as I fear it could be, but the Belgian league has usually been a good home for Japanese players. It's a very open league, so if he can find a place in that team that suits him, then yeah, I think he could tear it up and he could have a really exciting season before moving to Brighton, which is, yeah, it's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, terrific. So two very interesting moves there for Hayashi and Mitoma, both to Belgium, and we'll obviously be watching on with interest. Elsewhere, Kobe continue to stockpile forwards as they seek to replace Celtic legend Kyogo Furuhashi, with Yoshinori Muto's rumoured arrival confirmed. Japan's number 9, Yuya Osako, returning from Germany, and Bojan Krkić coming in as well, Sam. So the big question is, where do they all fit in?
Great question. at the moment they've been playing this kind of 4-4-2 diamond. So the front two, I'm going to imagine Osako has to be one of them as the kind of focal point. And then you play one of Muto or Bojan in behind. I'd probably side with Muto. I imagine the understanding is a lot better with Osako and Muto. They've played together for Japan before, and I imagine that would work the best. Bojan, I mean, he has to fill the quota of always signing a former Barcelona player in every window. And his career is interesting. Obviously, a wonder kid at Barcelona, the next Messi, the original next Messi. And then his career has gone down and down via Stoke. And then last he was, I think 6 months ago, he was at Montreal, where then they didn't renew his contract. So he's been without any football since December. So I don't imagine Bojan is going to come in straight away, and I think he might be on the edge of this foreign quota where he may be in the squad, he may miss out. So I'm going to assume Osako and Muto with Iniesta in behind, which, I mean, could be very good, especially Osako and Iniesta's combination. And I'd be interested to see what Muto does. Obviously, terrific for FC Tokyo and did well in Germany before making the stupid move to Newcastle and trying to play as a lone striker in a Steve Bruce team, which isn't going to work. But yeah, hopefully he comes back and gets into the goals, because it's kind of been a little bit of a barren spell for him. But yeah, you know Muto a lot better than I do, because he's kind of played in J1 before I was watching him. So what do you think he'll bring Kobe, and do you think a link up with Osaka will work well?
Well, yeah, on paper it should. If we get the FC Tokyo version of Yoshinori Muto, then absolutely, I think, Kobe supporters should be licking their lips. It's just a matter of, how much his confidence has been dented, and how much he'll be revitalised by a return to the J-League. Because, after settling into the FC Tokyo first team, he was basically irresistible. I'll be watching with gritted teeth, as I would have loved for him to return to Tokyo. But it's a fascinating move. Yeah, for me, Osaka coming back is an interesting one. Obviously, we have seen a number of big names return in the last year or so, Sam. So did you think he had some more petrol in the tank? And are you surprised to see him returning from Europe? I don't know whether this early, in inverted commas, is the right way to phrase it, but for me that return was a little bit out of the blue.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised. I can see why he left Werder Bremen. They just got relegated and they've been having a bit of a fire sale. So I think they, in the end, kind of sold to the highest bidders that were Vissel Kobe. But it's a shame for Osaka because I thought in Europe he was playing regularly. He was usually, getting in amongst the goals and always playing well. And I thought he could have maybe stayed in the Bundesliga and found another team. But I'm not going to complain too much because I get to see Yu Osaka every week now, which is great. I think he's a terrific striker and he'll fit in very nicely at Vissel Kobe and go some way to replacing the Furuhashi goals that he's been scoring and has been continuing at Celtic. What a performance he put in against Dundee United at the weekend. But yeah, I think it's a shame for Osaka that I think he should have continued in Europe, but it's great for us and everyone watching the J-League to have him back.
Yes, I'll heartily agree with you there. It's a very interesting signing for Kobe, and let's see if they can manage to fill the boots of Furuhashi. These three guys coming in, but although yes, you'd certainly imagine that Borjan will be on the fringes at best in the first couple of months or so once he's settling in to the club. But yeah, Furuhashi, an instant impact to say the least at Celtic, which is absolutely terrific. Alright, so before we move on, Sam, are there any other notable bits of transfer business that I might have missed before we sink our teeth into Monday's games? I mean, yourself and Johnny surprised me with the number of transfers you were able to list off last week that I had missed. So are there any others before we move on?
There are a couple. One's not confirmed, but looks like it should happen in the next day or so. It's a left winger called Martinho, signing for Kawasaki Frontale. He's last been in China at Chongqing Liangfang, I think. Sorry about that pronunciation, but he's winger. He should fill in that void for Mitoma. I don't think he's quite the level of player that Mitoma is, but they desperately need a few options there because that squad is looking quite thin. Thinner as well after the weekend's games, which we'll get onto. But yeah, Martinho looks like he should come in for Kawasaki. And then there have been just a couple of loan deals this morning as we record, both away from Kashima Antlers. So Daiki Sugioka has gone back to Shonan. He was terrific there before joining Kashima, so hopefully he can kind of revitalise his career down the left side for Shonan. And then Tosu, obviously, they've been losing players left and right, and they've got Kai Koizumi coming in, so very versatile player. They can kind of plug him in wherever they need him. So that's all that I can think of at the moment. I may well have missed one. There may have been two or three new signings by the time this podcast goes out. But they're all pretty decent signings for the three clubs that I mentioned.
All right, terrific stuff then. Okay, so we will take a quick break and we'll be back to round up all of the games from J1 Match Day 23. Welcome back. We said at the end of last week's episode that Monday's top flight slate didn't look all that appealing on paper, but naturally, this being the J-League, the form book was ripped up with a number of surprising results, arguably none bigger than at Mitsuzawa, where Cellar Dwellers Yokohama FC returned to action with a number of their new signings and one old favourite featuring prominently, and took down ACL-chasing Nagoya 2-0, Sam.
Yeah, I said they'd be the team to watch, but I didn't necessarily expect them to sweep Nagoya aside with as much ease as they did. I thought they were absolutely incredible. I don't know whether maybe Nagoya were taken aback a little bit by the change in the way that they played or a couple of the new signings that came in, but yeah, Yokohama were magnificent. Matsuo, the star of this game, why he hasn't been playing as much as last season as he should be, I have no idea, but he was back with a bang in this game. Yeah, involved in both goals, his movement was absolutely superb, and yeah, they just couldn't really get to grips with him. But as well as Matsuo, we saw a couple of new signings. Sven Brodersen in goal got a clean sheet, made one very good save from Naoki Maeda, and the new signing at the back, Gabriel, who has come in from Atletico Mineiro, and I don't know if he really knew that he was going to Yokohama FC. He should be playing at a much higher level than this, but he really solidified that back line that made sure that Yutaro Hakamada didn't have to play, which is music to Yokohama FC fans' ears, I'm sure. And then even the two other new signings that came on late, Salo Mineiro went close at the end, Felipe Vizeo looked decent, and yeah, it looks like they've just pulled some rabbits out of the hat. And yeah, they look all of a sudden a competent side. They didn't even have to resort to Kazumura, who had made it onto the bench, and I was quite disappointed when they were strolling at 2-0 that he didn't get an appearance. But yeah, other than that, it was a perfect day for Yokohama FC.
Yeah, unbelievable. And well, I have to give you a lot of credit, mate. That's the one call that you got right. You said they were pushing the boat out, and that they would be a team to watch in the second half of the season. And well, you can't do much better when you're down the bottom than, yeah, beating the team that came into this match day fifth in the table. So yeah, a terrific result, to put it mildly, for Yokohama FC. They took a ninth minute lead through a Shinosuke Nakatani own goal, and then, as we've mentioned, J-Talk favourite Yusuke Matsuo marked his first start since late April with a brilliant second just past the half hour. So well, yeah, you've mentioned the new Brazilians there. You mentioned last week, Sam, you were looking forward to seeing them, and yeah, they were coming in with a fair degree of pedigree, all of them. And obviously, if they can get Matsuo back to his best, that will be cliche alert, just like a new signing too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Matsuo on the left, you could play Felipe Vizeo, I think, came on up front. And then Salo Mineiro played on the right side. So that's a very, very exciting front three once those two Brazilians are fit and they can come in with Matsuo. And Matsuo is not snapped up immediately towards the end of this transfer window. But yeah, it looks very exciting. And not just that, but they've also solidified at the back as well, which is just as important. The goalkeeper, Brodersen, didn't put a foot wrong. And yeah, Gabriel, as I say, he just looked like he knew what he was doing back there. And he looked to kind of calm down everyone. He controlled things. So that's, yeah, four terrific signings, plus that new signing, as you say, of Matsuo. I think, yeah, it couldn't really have gone better for Yokohama FC. And they're still a long way from safety, still 9 points, but they've rolled the dice and they've given themselves as good a chance as possible.
Indeed. Well, yeah, it's now two straight wins and three unbeaten. So, yeah, look out. 16th place, Tokushima. Yeah, it looks like Yokohama FC are coming for you. What about their opponents on Monday night then, Sam? And Nagoya had Olympic wide man Yuki Soma in from the start, and Grampus enjoyed over 70% possession. But, yeah, another frustrating evening. And our old mate Grum Freche is back with a number of questions for us to ponder this week. The first on Grampus. Graham Freche says it's 5 league games without a win and 5 goals conceded in the last 2. What's going on with Grampus? Ficadenti still doesn't know how to deal with teams that let us, i.e. Grampus, have the ball and all the possession. He just doesn't have any offensive tactical ideas. There is another question to come about their new striker, but yeah, what do you think so far?
Well, they were very poor in this game, and it isn't the first time, as Grant Freshie says, where they've come up against a team that will just sit back a little bit and, kind of give them possession, but sit deep and not really give them much space. And Nagoya didn't really have too many ideas. Sommer, I think, was knackered, and he was subbed at half-time and didn't really get into the game. And Mateus, as we've said many times, if you control Mateus, you pretty much control Grampus going forward. They're stuck at the moment with Kakitani up front, and with Yamasaki's injured, Kanazaki's still not back, and Sverchok's not yet available. So, yeah, they were struggling for ideas. They did bring Gabriel Xavier in to start, and usually he's got a little bit of magic to him, but Yokohama defended very well and kept Grampus really at arm's length, and Brodersen didn't really have too much to do, bar a Naoki Maeda long-range effort. So, yeah, they were very poor, lacking ideas definitely going forward. And then at the back, I mean, Maruyama is out. Obviously, most of the games that he's missed have been in the Champions League and then in the Emperor's Cup, so it might not have been as big a factor, especially in that Asian Champions League competition. But yeah, they do look a weaker side without him, organising things. As good a player as Nakatani is alongside of him, I mean, I don't think they're quite up to the level him and Kimoto with, as they would be with Maruyama. So that's, it's not quite as strong as it could be. So there are a couple of issues for Nagoya, but going forward, I want to see what Fairchop brings when he comes into the team. Are they able to adapt to him and get the best out of him, and maybe he can revitalise the attack? Yeah, because as we've said many times, without that main striker, there's always that key, that's always the weak point of this Grampus team.
Well, that's right, and yeah, we know, of course, they missed out on Kasper Juncker 3 months ago, so they're rolling the dice here with Svierchok, who you mentioned last week does come in with big raps. So the last part of Graham Fritsche's question on Grampus is about Svierchok. So how are we going to make him score when there is no idea to play attacking football from Ficadenti?
I think that's a little harsh. I think when you've got players like Sommer and Mateus, they do want to attack, and this Fairchop, from what I've been told, is you get the ball into him in the penalty area and he'll score, he'll create whatever he needs to himself. So I think there are still players in that team, and I think there's still enough of an attacking impetus in the team with those players to kind of get the best out of Fairchop. Hopefully that just the link comes quite well. Hopefully they stick with a Gabriel Xavier or get play Nauki Maeda a little bit more. I mean, he's the one player in that team with a little, other than Mateus, that will have a little bit of spark about him, a little bit of ingenuity, and he'll look to have a go on goal. He'll look to create something out of nothing. So I'd like to see him maybe play behind the striker rather than dropping back and having Kakitani there, or in previous games where they've played a three with Nagasawa. So I'd like to see a bit more of Maeda, but I think there's still enough quality in attack to get the ball into Svierchok, play around him, and hopefully for them get the goals that they desperately need with Svierchok in the team.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, we can understand your frustration, Graham Fritsche, at a result like this, and we've got to hope that the Svierchok can hit the ground running, because obviously, Grampus, who spent so much of this season up in second place in the table, of course, we knew it was somewhat misleading as they'd played a lot more front-loaded games before the ACL. But yeah, this loss has seen them slip down a spot further down the table to sixth. So they're kind of hanging on to the coattails of the ACL places at the moment. So plenty more to come from Graham Fritsche throughout the remainder of this episode. Elsewhere, there was a surprise hiccup for Yokohama F. Marinos in their continued chase of leaders Kawasaki after their thrilling 3-2 win away at Gunma Osaka last Friday night, which was their seventh league victory in a row and saw them close to within 9 points of Frontale. They were on the road again on Monday night in match day 23 away at Shimizu, but had to settle for a point, Sam, after a dominating performance, but ultimately a frustrating for them, a 2-2 draw.
Yeah, it was frustrating. It was a bit of a ding-dong battle because Shimizu started so well and got in front early and then kind of weathered a storm from Marinos, but then didn't quite let them go. Even when they went 2-1 down, there was still enough about Shimizu to cause a few issues at the back for Marinos, and they kept going and got their equaliser. And then, as a Lotina team will try to do, they defended very well for that last half an hour and made things very awkward for Marinos. So, but it will be a frustrating one for Yokohama to go 2-1 up at the start of the second half and not be able to see out the result is always disappointing. But I think you've got to give a lot of credit to Shimizu. They caused quite a few issues. Yokohama at the back without Thiago Martins and not quite as strong as they could be. They kind of preyed on Saneto a little bit in terms of the turnovers they were getting on him. He's not quite as comfortable playing out from the back as others are. So they really pressed on him and he got some rewards for that. And so it was a very good performance, I thought, from Shimizu. But Yokohama will look back and think, it's 2 points dropped.
Well, considering the number of games they'd won in a row, as I said, they made it seven last Friday to then slip up after going 2-1 ahead will be really frustrating for F. Marinos and their supporters, I'm sure. With the new manager, of course, Kevin Muscat in charge, were you able to discern any differences in the way Muscat set the team up? Sam, or is it pretty much a plain sailing as has been since Ange Postecoglou left?
Yeah, it's very much try and keep it a business as usual. They've had to change a little bit in just in terms of the way that Leo Sierra plays up front compared to Adewa Naira. They're not very different strikers, so you have to alter it a little bit. But in terms of the general philosophy, they're trying to be attacking. They're trying to play out the same way as Postecoglou did. And yeah, then just not so, trying not to upset the apple cart too much, which is fine when you're winning games. It's just, what does Muscat do if he does start to either lose games or drop points here and there? Does he maybe go back into his shell a little bit? Because he is a little bit more of a defensive manager than Postecoglou. But for the time being, I think they are going to try and continue in that same vein.
All right. Well, of course, yeah, it was quite a start for Muscat in his first game in the F. Marino's dugout away at Toowoomba last Friday. But, yes, a disappointing result, yeah, at the end of the day here to draw away at Shimizu, especially when they, as I say, remain in hot pursuit of Kawasaki. So for S-Pulse, Eiichi Katayama gave them a very early lead in just the fourth minute. But as Sam's mentioned, F. Marino's hit back and goals either side of half-time from Marcos Junior and Elber saw them take a 2-1 lead early in the second half, only for S-Pulse to hit back on the hour through Kenta Nishizawa. Now, you mentioned Leo Sierra up front in place of Ado Onaiwu, Sam. And, of course, the Daizen Maeda returned from the Olympics and was on the bench for F. Marinos on Monday night. He came off the bench with just over half an hour to go. But, yeah, Graham Freche was wondering what you thought about the Leo Sierra up front idea from Muscat to replace Onaiwu. What did you think of it, and did you like seeing him up there? Do you think he'll keep his place once Maeda is back in the reckoning for a starting place? And Graham Freche also wanted to know your thoughts on Elber. He says the first thing that comes to his mind when he thinks of Elber is that he is at least in the top three signings of the season so far. What do you think about that opinion?
Well, let's start with Leo Sierra. I think the option, or the other option in this game, was probably to play Kenyu Sugimoto. So I'm obviously happy that Leo Sierra started up front. I don't think he's like an all-time great or anything. I think he's okay. He's decent. He's not looking, I don't think he's ever going to score a lot of goals in a season. He seems to be much more comfortable kind of back to goal. And I think maybe he might bring out the best in Marcos Junior, or in the last year and a bit. I'd say that he's been a little bit down in terms of his goal production, his goals scored, and compared to how they were right maybe at the start of his Marinos career. So it could bring out a little bit more in him. But in terms of going beyond the defence, I don't think he's going to bring that in the way that Onaiwu did, and maybe the way that Daizen Maeda could if they decide to go with him up front and keep Nakagawa out on the wing. But I imagine Leo Sierra will keep his place and Maeda will go back onto that left wing. Nakagawa got an assist in this game, which is good for him, but he still looks to be a player a long way short of the confidence he had maybe in 2019. So I expect the way that Maeda and Elber have both played on the wings, they'll continue in that fashion. Leo Sierra will kind of be a bit of a target man up front, and maybe he'd be more in terms of getting the ball and laying it back for Marcos Junior, and that might be the way they get their goals. But I think he's a reasonable striker, but there are definitely better players out there and better players that have even played up front for Marinos. And then on to Elber, I agree at the moment he's probably been one of the best three signings in the league so far. I think Vissel Kobe are auditioning for their top three and they'd probably try and beat Elber with some of those. But yeah, I think he's done very well. At the start of the season, I thought he was a little bit lacking in end product. There was a lot of energy to him, a lot of commitment to him, but maybe the final shot and the final cross, it wasn't quite there. But he's definitely grown into this season. He looks a terrific player. He's very intelligent in terms of his movement in off the wing, either to get across, get onto a cross from Maida's side, or just to nip in front of a defender and either get a shot away or across. So I've been really impressed with him. He's definitely been right up there in terms of players this season. And I can't say much more about him. I think he's been terrific. And once him and Maeda get going again at the second half of the season, then Marinos have two terrific players out on the wings.
Yes, indeed. Well, they've had very contrasting seasons, haven't they, Elber and Leo Sierra? I mean, Elber was able to basically start playing pretty much from the start of the season, wasn't he? Whereas Leo Sciarra had a much more, a disjointed start to the season. He wasn't able to play right from the off. And, I mean, yeah, Elba's one of the few new foreign signings this season, Sam, who was basically able to come in and start playing from very early doors, wasn't he? So in that regard, I guess he's had an advantage on most of the other new foreigners into the league this year. And, he has, I think he's hit his straps, especially during this winning run that F. Marinos were on, at least until Monday night. But, it's going to be interesting to see how Muscat fills the void of, Anaiwu leaving. And, he's obviously got his work to do to try and chase down Kawasaki, who, as I segue on to the next game, they very much picked up where they left off before the Olympic break. And, after F. Marinos slipped up, Frontale took advantage of that and extended their lead back out to 11 points at the top of the table after a comfortable 2-0 cruise away at relegation-threatened Oita. Leandro Damião scored the opener in the 10th minute, Sam, but then had to be replaced just before the half hour. So I'm not sure if you know how serious any injury to Damião might be, but with Mitoma just leaving the club officially today, the last thing they need is an injury to their focal point.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any specifics on like the severity of the injury, but it looked, if you're going to force Damián off after 26 minutes, it's probably going to be fairly serious. I think he was holding his groin as he went down. So, yeah, it could be that they are without him for a few weeks. And Kobayashi is already injured. And then you've got Oshima, of course, injured, and Tanaka and Mitoma out. I mean, that squad suddenly looked very, very thin. I mean, Kei Chinen came on and with the greatest of respect to him, he's not as clinical as Leandro Damiani, and he's quite a few chances to get a goal. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a worry for Frontale, because Damian this season has been terrific. I mean, we've talked about him pretty much every week this season, and the goal he scored, although it's not great goalkeeping, it's just the quickness of the shot. He took it so early, caught the keeper out, and that's just kind of what he's been doing this season. He's played very well. So, yeah, as good a result as this was for Kawasaki, and they were very comfortable in it. Yeah, there's got to be a few worries about the depth in this team with if Damiani is out for any length of time.
Most definitely. So you mentioned Chinen replaced Leandro just before the half hour. It was another Frontale substitute, Daya Tono, a player, of course, Johnny Nicol mentioned could be key for Frontale in the second half of the season. That was on last week's episode, of course. He wrapped up the points 13 minutes from time. So all in all, obviously worrying that they might be without Damião for a period of time, Sam. But yeah, another very professional night at the office for the champions.
Yeah, they were in cruise control for the entire game. And Oita haven't always been the easiest team for Kawasaki. They've caused a few problems to them over the last couple of years, but not in this game. Kawasaki had full control of the game from the first minute to the last. They were just dominant, and Oita barely laid a glove on them, to be quite honest. And despite that, obviously a few players missing for Kawasaki, they just didn't need to get out of second gear and just ease their way to a very, very nice victory down in Kyushu.
Indeed. Also down in Kyushu is, of course, Tosu's real estate agent in front of the station stadium. And on Monday night, FC Tokyo were the visitors for the fixture that I mentioned in last week's episode. Was the only one in the round that pitted two top half teams against each other. And wouldn't you know it, FC Tokyo's Tosu curse struck again as Keiya Sento's 7th-minute goal was enough for the hosts as they did the double over Tokyo for the second straight season and beat their visitors for the 5th straight time in the league. I think we're going to need to get a witch doctor in or something, Sam, because, this is it's beyond a joke now. Tosu just seriously have FC Tokyo's number. And, once again, I'm left holding my hands up. I can't have any complaints about this result.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the very few consistent things about the J-League is that Sagan Tosu will beat FC Tokyo. And I think it was a deserved victory. As you say, I thought Tosu played pretty well. It wasn't the most exciting game, and there were chances for Tokyo in this one. Leandro missed a couple. Dalton had one deflected onto the roof of the goal, and there was a good save from Park from Diego, but really they kind of ran out of ideas. I'm not 100% sure why Diego Oliveira was subbed after about 55 minutes when they need a goal, but okay, you do you, Hasegawa. And yeah, it was just Tosu's goal came from a little bit of poor play from Aoki, losing possession, and then defensively a little bit all over the place. It was quite easy, I thought, for Sento to lose his marker, Umari, and get onto Sakai's cross. And yeah, that was the difference between the two teams. Maybe it would have been different if Morishige wasn't suspended and was in that back line. They might have been a little bit more solid, but yeah, they took their goal well. And yeah, another very good victory for Tosu, considering all that's going on at their club with Matsuoka and Hayashi leaving. The manager still wasn't in the dugout for this one after being, yeah, well, punished or disciplined or whatnot. So yeah, full credit to the Tosu players. And yeah, it was a little disappointing from FC Tokyo. And I've got a question to ask. Do you know where Bruno Avini is and why he can't get into the squad?
I wish I could answer that question, Sam. But yes, now I think almost all the Tokyo supporters are scratching their head at the fact that Avini, as you would have thought, that with Morishige suspended, this would have been a great game to bring him in for. But yeah, wasn't even on the bench, was he? So no, I don't know. Has he gone back to Brazil during the Olympic break? I really don't know. It's a very much a head scratcher, and yeah, a player that the club brought in, and yeah, a lot of supporters had high expectations for, and we at least want to see him play in J1, but yeah, we're still waiting, and yeah. Omari, while I don't think he had a poor game on Monday night. Yeah, we would have liked to see what Avini, at least what he looks like. But no, we're still scratching our heads. And well, yeah, we're scratching our heads after this game. For me, there was a great early save from Park to deny Ryoya Ogawa. I think that was the fourth minute. But then, yeah, as you say, they were just sliced through the Tokyo defence like butter after a poor ball out of defence from Aoki. And yeah, I thought Adalton was bright, but yeah, for Diego Oliveira, for me, he just never got into the pace of the game. I mean, he never got to grips with Tosu's pressing. They were, I think they targeted him especially. They were swarming him whenever he got the ball in midfield. And yeah, he just never sorted himself out, and he never got adjusted to the pace of the game and the attention he was getting from the Tosu midfield and defence. And yeah, obviously he's such a key link in the FC Tokyo machine. He was really unable to express himself too much, and so yeah, I guess it's just one of those nights. But yeah, it always seems to be one of those nights when we play against Tosu. So yeah, as we both said, yeah, absolutely fair play to Tosu for this result. Again, yeah, with Hayashi watching on from the stands and Matsuoka already departed, they are back up to third on goal difference, and absolutely fair play to them. They absolutely have our number, and yeah, I can't say anything else. They, Tosu, that is, are back up to third because there was yet more late heartache for Kobe, who continue to find ways to shoot themselves in the foot late in games. Sam, this clash with Kashiwa visiting the Neuwirth Stadium was your pick of the match day, and fair to say it was a slow burn before bursting into life just past the hour.
Yeah, it very much was a slow burn after the first half. I was saying, oh dear, this is an absolute shocker. And then it almost turned into one of my famous 1-1s, which seems to be every game that I pick. But yeah, Kashiwa had other ideas. And that second half, maybe the last half an hour, was a terrific game of football. It was end-to-end. Both teams were going for it. Kobe threw too many players forward at the end, left themselves short at the back. And Kashiwa, who'd been a threat on the counter-attack for all game, yeah, finally then broke them down and got a very crucial victory. I said last week that Kashiwa really needed to hit the ground running. This was probably the time to play Kobe, because obviously their new strikers weren't available. And yeah, they got the 3 points that they desperately needed. They haven't really created a gap at the bottom at the moment, but hopefully for them, this can be the start of a bit of momentum, and hopefully for their sake, push them higher up into the table.
Indeed, indeed. So for Kashiwa, it was a Cristiano who put them in front in the 65th minute, volleying across the keeper, only for Yutaro Oda, who was on just 2 minutes earlier to equalise in the 70th minute. Then, as Sam's mentioned, at the death, Kobe committed too many men forward. Kashiwa countered, and Cristiano unselfishly squared for a Resol substitute, Mal Hosoya, to sweep in the winner and, lift the Sun Kings out of the relegation zone. So, a huge win for Kashiwa, yet more late pain for Kobe. And Graham Freche's back with a question about Vissel, Sam, and I mean, we've touched on it in part one, talking about the new three attackers that they've just signed in the past few days. Graham Freche is exaggerating a little, but he says that after they've signed around 13 strikers to replace Furuhashi, with, of course, Douglas, Ayub Masika and Lincoln still there, who of those six are most likely to fill the goal-scoring void left behind? Graham Freche wonders what the plan is here, if there ever is one, with Miki Tani. So, obviously we're fantasizing about Muto and Osako forming a new dream team up front for Vissel, but what does that mean for the likes of Douglas, who is, of course, an established J1 striker? I mean, Masika maybe not so much, but he has looked decent in flashes here and there.
Yeah, I've quite liked Masika when he's played, but he's not had much of a chance and will have even less of a chance. I think there are reports that they might be looking to get rid of Masika in this window, and they're also trying to get rid of Fujimoto, but Fujimoto is quite happy to earn whatever money he's earning at Kobe and see it out. And I think Douglas is also, him and Tanaka, they've kind of signalled to be leaving at the end of the season. So I think they will have a clean sweep and get rid of the current strikers they have and move on into the future with Osako, Muto, Bojan, and the rest, the other 10 that are set to join it in the rest of this window. So, I think it's a clean sweep for Kobe, and they will look to, as we were talking about earlier, probably Osako and Muto as their main two strike force, and then for the rest of the season, you've still got the likes of Douglas and Tanaka to join up with Bojan as kind of the backups. But that's the way that they're going before they then go and sign whoever they want in the next window as well.
Fair enough then. All right, so Kobe now fourth in the table. As I said, goal difference behind Tosu, with Kashiwa lifting themselves up to 15th, now out of the drop zone and 2 points clear of a 17th placed Shonan. All right, we're exactly halfway through the match day 23 slate, Sam. So let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll round up the rest of the games from Monday night. Welcome back. There was also late drama at the Lemon Gas Stadium in Hiratsuka, where visiting Kashima rode an unlikely source to a thrilling 2-1 victory over Shonan. Defender Tomoya Inukai stunning everyone, probably no one more than himself, with a stunning 35-yard thunderbolt in the 29th minute to cancel out Yuki Ohashi's 13th minute opener. Although, of course, everywhere else in the world, Inukai's first goal was an own goal after the ball cannoned off the bar and went in off Olympic keeper Kosei Tani's arm. Then Inukai netted the winner in second half stoppage time in a much more Inukai-esque way, heading in from a Yasushi Endo corner. But Sam, Tani will just be having nightmares about watching that ball bounce ever so slowly past him after deflecting off a Tiger Hutter.
Yeah, it was very weird. It was, when I first watched it, I had no idea how it had just bounced so slowly through the area. But it does take that crucial little nick off Hata, and there's nothing Tani can do about it in the end. And it's just kind of sums up Shonan, because they always seem to be on the rough end of a bit of bad luck with this kind of deflection here. Inukai's goal earlier, I mean, it's a terrific strike, but it's so unfortunate always for a goalkeeper when the ball cannons off the woodwork and then hits them and goes in, because again, there's nothing he can do about it. But obviously, we always talk about the kind of quirk in Japanese football of not giving own goals and just awarding it to whoever hit the strike. But I mean, for Inukai, I think he deserves this for this shot. It was absolutely incredible from 35 yards. I don't think he will ever hit a ball as sweetly as he does here. And for me, he earns that goal. I think it's a terrific effort. And Kashima got away with it, I think a little bit at the end of the game to get the 3 points. I think it's a little bit harsh on Shonan, who gave as good as they got in this game. But yeah, it's a crucial 3 points for Kashima, who hopefully, because I've been predicting it for almost all season, Kashima will go on a run eventually and try and get into these ACL places. And this was a good way to start, as harsh as the result was on Shonan.
Yes, indeed. So they've edged their way above Grampus now, Antlers, and they're now up into fifth. Yeah, just 3 points behind both the Tosu and Kobe. So, yeah, they're very much in the thick of the ACL race here, Antlers. And, a tough break for Shauna, no question. But, I think that's going to be a running theme for them in the second half of the season as, they slipped down into the bottom four. We'll move on, and we'll head north to the Sapporo Dome. I said at the end of part two we'd round up the rest of the games from Monday night. Of course, this was the first game of the match day, and it got Sam out of bed earlier than he would have liked on a Monday morning UK time. It was Sapporo hosting Urawa. Of course, Consadole are the dictionary definition of hot and cold. But unfortunately for Ricardo Rodriguez and his visiting Urawa side, Sapporo made a strong start after that resumption. Kazuki Fukai powering in a header from an Akito Fukumori corner in the 8th minute. And then Consadole went 2-0 up just before the hour through at Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa, who had shot against the post in the first half. Takahiro Akimoto volleyed in for Reds from just inside the box with 25 minutes to go. But Sapporo held on to move into the top half and up to 9th. 3 points behind their visitors, Urawa. So, yeah, a terrific result for Sapporo, this one, Sam. What about for Reds? We saw Ataru Esaka start for the first time in the league for them. Unfortunately, though, it was in partnership with Shinzo Kuroki up front. I think we're very much looking forward to seeing Esaka with Kasper Juncker, but that that didn't last very long at all on Monday night, did it?
No, I think they managed about 13 minutes together, and it was kind of when Reds are at their best in this game. But yeah, Esaka, he tried very hard, he was full of energy, but it looked like him and Shinzo Kuroki had never met before. Nothing was really working between them, there was no sort of link-up play, which is surprising really with the type of player that Shinzo Kuroki is. Usually his link-up play with the players behind him is usually very good, but they just weren't on the same wavelength. And it was a very interesting call from Ricardo Rodriguez to start with Kuroki and Esaka. I'm going to assume that maybe they must have been training and linking up a lot better in training than they were in this game. But yeah, it was a part of a couple of strange selections in this game. A lot of teams have one or two COVID cases, so I don't know how much that has played an effect into this, but Reds are always a weaker side with Yoshio Koizumi not in the team, and that was quite evident, I thought, in this game. I mean, yeah, he's the creative hub, and I'm still waiting to see how him and Esaka can fit into the same team, because it kind of, to me, suggests that they need a change of formation. Otherwise, it's going to be one or the other, and I don't think either player should be left out of this team. But yeah, it was a disappointing result and performance, I thought, from Reds. Defensively, there were issues. Makino was caught out for Ogashiwa's goal, and there were other occasions, especially in that first half, where they were caught in possession on the edge of the area. And so, but I don't know how much you can read into it with Reds, because there are still a lot of players to come into this team. They were missing, obviously, Hiroki Sakai, Alexander Schultz, Thomas Dengler, all given rests. And so obviously Koizumi as well. They've brought in Yuichi Hirano from Mito Hollyhock, another midfield option. So he's still getting these puzzle pieces into place for Reds. But at the moment, they're a little bit disjointed, and Sapporo took full advantage of it.
Yeah, fantastic. A great result for Sapporo, as we said. Granfrecce with a question on Reds. He says, after looking like they were on the right path under Rodriguez, the last three losses were against Shonan, Oita, and now Sapporo. Of course, with two of those teams fighting relegation, is there any reason to be concerned, or is this just a bump in the road? I guess, Sam, we've been talking about it in the last month or so before the Olympic break, weren't we, that they were kind of ahead of schedule when they were up as high as they were in the table. Did they make it as high as fifth? I think they were fifth or sixth in the table at one point, weren't they? So, yeah, these ordinary results have seen them slip back down a little bit. But, yeah, we were kind of the opinion that they were very much a work in progress, weren't we? So, and I think my exact words were, yeah, they were going to have to suffer through some ordinary results in the second half of the season. So I guess this is just another one of those. But, I mean, we don't want to take anything away from Sapporo, do we? Because they did score two excellent goals here and were pretty good value for their win.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Sapporo played really well. I think when they're at their best, they kind of play with Ogashiwa or someone else, like a smaller, like kind of false nine up front. And then the movement then kind of just takes apart certain defence, especially when they're not quite as comfortable as they could be. And I think this Reds one is one of those. And they really press them. Any team that tries to play out from the back is kind of what Sapporo really thrive on. So I thought they were full value for this result. And I think you're completely right with the way your description of Reds. I think they are going to be up and down this season. They are trying to fit this new manager, the new style that Rodriguez is bringing in. It's going to have some terrific results, as we've seen earlier in the season. It's also going to have some poor performances, and it's going to continue in that manner, I imagine, for the rest of this season as they try and get the new players in. They try and form exactly how Rodriguez wants to play. So it was always going to be an up and down season, and I was worrying at the start of the season, much to Ryan Steele's dismay, that they might have been towards a relegation battle. So thankfully they're not anywhere close to that. And yeah, but I think they are going to be in around that 6th to 10th position. I think that's kind of where they're going to be. And some weeks it's going to look incredible, and some weeks they're going to look ordinary. But yeah, it's just a case of learning and getting through this season, and I think we'll see the real Urawa Reds next season.
Yes, indeed, well said. And well, yeah, it's a fascinating prospect, isn't it, when you get all those new arrivals settled in. Obviously, Osaka's taken his first step on Monday night, but yeah, the likes of Sakai and Schultz, etc., linking up with Kasper Juncker. Hopefully, he'll be back and firing, because he's certainly hit a bit of a lean spell. In the last five or six games. But much to come in the future for Urawa, and we're looking forward to seeing how they shape up. For Sapporo, of course, a very sweet win for Misha Petrovic against his former club, so I'm sure he enjoyed that with a glass of red wine or two after the game on Monday night. All right, next we'll head to the Pokhari Sweat Stadium and a big bottom half clash between host Tokushima and visiting Gamba Osaka. Sam, Johnny Nicol was understandably upbeat over Gamba's results during the Olympic break on last week's episode, but they've come back to earth. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, or back to reality. In their past two games, of course, they were unfortunate to lose that thriller against F. Marinos last Friday, but then they've fallen 2-1 here to Vortis, who scored two terrific first-half goals through Taisei Miyashiro and then Kazuki Nishia on the stroke of half-time.
Yeah, I think, as you said, they were lucky, I thought, against Yokohama, but they looked like they'd run out of steam a little bit in this game. They kind of, especially in the attacking areas, there wasn't quite enough movement to cause Tokushima too much. And Tokushima, they're a team that will always control the ball, but in this game, as I've been calling out for it seems like forever, there was a lot of dynamism. They were going forward, they were looking to attack, they were looking to get into the area quickly, not just pass it around the back for 10 minutes before moving anywhere. And finally, which seems like I've been calling for this forever, but Watai and Nishia both played in the same team, and they looked a lot better. And Nishia got his goal, Watai looked creative, he had shots on goal right from the first whistle, he tested Higashiguchi, and Tokushima just looked like a really good side for once. And obviously this break was so crucial to them to kind of get in with Danny Payatos to learn what he wants from them, to build on the good work that they were doing at the start of the season, and this is a really good step in the right direction. I thought they looked like a really threatening team. They looked like that front four really worked. They dropped Kakita again, but Miyashiro's movement up front was very good, and he got his goal as well, which will only improve his confidence. And there is talk of a Norwegian striker coming in, Bashenga, I think it is, who's very highly rated. So if they can add him to this, then it looks very positive. But I think with a caveat that this was a very tired Kamba Osaka on the back of a very long run of fixtures, I think maybe this was a game too far for them. But credit to Vortis for taking full advantage.
Yeah, most definitely. So a first win for Tokushima since the middle of May, their first in eight league games. And, excellent goals from Miyashiro, a header, and then a volley from Nishia on the stroke of half-time, as I mentioned. But Gamba set up a grandstand finish when the much-maligned Thiago Alves blasted in a brilliant first-time shot in the first minute of stoppage time. But, what a huge win for Danny Poyatos, as his side followed Kashiwa out of the bottom four at Shonan's expense. So, terrific way to restart things for Vortis with that big win over Gamba Osaka. All right, so finally then to the other two draws from match day 23. At the best Denki Stadium, there were enough talking points to merit this clash between Fukuoka and Hiroshima placing higher in our running order. But, Sam, at the end of the day, it's a one-all draw played out between two comfortably mid-table sides, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the one that's going to be first billing on any highlights package. And, I mean, the first half up until Wanmar hit the post, I mean, he could have just edited that out completely and ignored it. But it did get going in the second half. It was an exciting game. Two very evenly matched sides, I thought. And, they went at it. They went at each other. Vispa went down to 10 men in controversial circumstances, but kept going after going 1-0 down. And, they earned their point in the end, as fortunate as it may have been with the deflection. But they kept going. So, credit to Vispa, and they'll take a lot of positive things out of this game. Hiroshima looked quite poor. They are a team that, I can see struggling for the rest of this season. They've not really replaced Kawabe. They've just brought back Taishi Matsumoto from a loan spell at Cerezo Osaka, but he was just on the bench. And, there's a big gap there. So, I worry about Hiroshima. They've still, as you say, they are comfortable mid-table, but with a lot of teams below them winning this week, and if that continues, then you never know that they could end up slipping into at least a relegation battle of some description, because they were very poor, and even against 10 men, it was Fukuoka that were doing a lot of the running.
Indeed. All right, so we had a question come in from another of our patrons, Daniel. So before we get to that, Sam, I think we need to play the jingle, don't we?
I think we do.
This week in VAR. Okay, Sam, so Daniel asks, which decision was worse, giving a penalty for a foul outside the box or giving Shichi a second yellow for the foul? So just to set the scene for the listeners, Hiroshima finally took a 67th-minute lead through a Junior Santos penalty, but that came after a mind-numbing four and a bit minute VAR delay that confirmed the referee Mr. Nishimura's original decision to award Sanfrecce a penalty and send off the previously mentioned Takaaki Shichi for a second yellow card for bundling over Yoshifumi Kashiwa in inverted commas on the edge of the box.
Yeah, well, I think the 4.5 minutes is just Nishimura refusing to change anything because he doesn't like his decisions being questioned. So as soon as he gives something, I can't ever see it being changed, even if there's completely no evidence for a penalty, which wasn't quite the case here, but has been in previous occasions. But yeah, this was, I'd say the worst decision was the second yellow card, because Hiroyuki Mae was right behind Kashiwa as he was entering the box and would have just swept it away. So to give a second yellow card and a penalty penalty, I think, is incredibly harsh and unnecessary. But the penalty decision is an interesting one because the first contact is outside the area, and it's one of those which kind of continues into the penalty area. So I think when they're looking at it, there isn't enough to overrule the decision, which you might think is harsh and maybe should have been a free kick. But once it's given, I think, yeah, it is a penalty. So a little bit harsh, but the red card is definitely the worst of the decisions. I think I can't see any reason that was a... It wasn't like a cynical foul or anything. It was just, yeah, it was a little pushed, and I think that was harsh on Shichi. But the penalty, I can understand why that stands.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I won't play the outro. Sorry. Firstly, thanks for your question, Daniel. And yeah, in answer to your question, yeah, the Shichi yellow card was, as Sam said, definitely the worst of the Mr. Nishimura's latest infractions. Yeah, I won't play the outro jingle yet because VAR came to Fukuoka's aid after Junior Santos netted a brilliant second that what he thought and what we all thought had to put the game out of Avispa's reach with 11 minutes left. But the big Brazilian was found to be millimetres offside. What was it, Sam? About half of his left boot was found to be offside. And for me, I mean, absolutely unbelievable when you look at the replays. He never, ever in a million years looks offside. And I don't know, the VAR, yeah, I guess we don't usually see the lines all that much in VAR decisions in Japan. So to see that line, and it was very clear on the line, so whether he's drawn his line correctly, I guess we have to take his word for it. But yeah, on the live viewing, that never in a million years looked offside to me.
No, it didn't. We've had quite a few of those, mainly at Shonan, where it's apparently been proven afterwards that they were correct, but we don't get to see the line, so we're just left baffled by the decision. So I'm happy that the line was shown. We'll assume it was correct and Santos was correctly ruled out for offside, but it's such a shame for him because the goal is terrific. The footwork he shows to get through a couple of defenders and finish very nicely, so it's a shame for him, but it looks like the technology has worked and ruled out the goal correctly. So yeah, credit to them for that, and I'm glad to finally see a replay and actually backing up these decisions.
This week in VAR. All right, so yeah, Avispa breathed a sigh of relief after that VAR decision, and then they took advantage of that reprieve, of course, playing with 10 men after Shichi was sent off, and they nicked a point at the death when their captain, Hiroyuki Myers, a 97th minute shot from outside the box, took a wicked deflection off Hiroshima veteran Toshihiro Aoyama and looped over their veteran keeper, Takuto Hayashi. So, as you said earlier, Sam, yeah, it's really harsh on Hiroshima, this, but on the overall performance, especially playing for as long as they did, basically the last 20-odd minutes with 10 men, yeah, you can't begrudge Fukuoka the point, can you?
No, I think it was deserved. I think first half they were the better side, and then, yeah, they went down to 10 men and went a goal down, but they responded very well. They still kept going forward. They kept trying to create chances, and you earn your luck at the end of the day, I think, and they definitely did here. It's harsh on Aoyama the way it goes in off him, but, yeah, I do think this was a full value for the point.
Yeah, and Graham Freche's last involvement on this episode, and yeah, I really feel for you, mate. Obviously, you can tell from your username, the two teams you pull for, Grampus and San Freche, have both endured a difficult Monday night for contrasting reasons. Obviously, yeah, Grampus were very, very disappointing away at Yokohama FC, or on the flip side, Yokohama FC were terrific against them, and then San Freche obviously wasn't a stellar performance, but yeah, literally seconds away from a victory before that that cruel deflection off Aoyama. So Graham Freche did pose some thoughts and a question about San Freche as well, Sam. I think we've discussed it basically in passing already, but it's worth mentioning again. Graham Freche says they're still stumbling around in no man's land with a dull performance after dull performance. In what direction is San Freche headed? I don't think they're heading anywhere. They're just there, not good enough to challenge, not bad enough to worry. They're just there. So again, as with Grampus, you can understand his frustration after a performance and ultimately a result that they got on Monday night, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm much more negative, I think, on Hiroshima than I am on Nagoya. I think there are good players at Nagoya, and I think they will start getting better results. But Hiroshima have a handful of decent players. I like Morishima, I like Asano, and I think Junior Santos, even though he gets a lot of criticism, I think it's a little bit undue, and I think he is a decent player. But otherwise, that team is pretty average. They're not really going anywhere. They've lost quite easily their best player without replacing him. So I do see them kind of meandering throughout this season. Whether it's bad enough for them to drop into any sort of trouble, probably not. But yeah, they're not really looking up the table at all. And with the financial situation at Hiroshima, the worry might not be this season, but next season. If they can't improve on this team, then yeah, maybe they're in a little bit more trouble and they might be back into more of a relegation battle that they were a few years ago. They flirted with it. So yeah, it's not a great time for Hiroshima. It's a long way away from the teams that were dominating the league a few years back, or even the team that managed to hold on to first place for a long period of the season. They're not anywhere near that. And yeah, the only way I see Hiroshima going at the moment is down.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a difficult second half of the season for San Freche and their supporters, and Hiroshi Jofuku has a lot of work to do, no question. But as you say, they'll do well to move any further up the table than where they are at the moment. They've slipped behind Sapporo and now are 10th in the table, and indeed just behind them are Fukuoka in 11th and a point behind them. So a frustrating one for San Freche, no question, but a huge thanks for all of your questions throughout this episode, Gran Freche. Great to have you back and banging with the questions for us to ponder. All right, so I think it's fair to say, Sam, that we're far from leaving the best game till last. At the Yodoko Sakura Stadium, host Cerezo Osaka huffed and puffed, but couldn't find a way past Sendai keeper Jakub Slovic in a game that finished 0-0. These are the draw masters. That's five in a row for Cerezo and five in their last seven for Vegalta. So this result was hardly a surprise. Just a shame it wasn't 3-3 like Cerezo's two previous games.
Yeah, that was a big disappointment of this game. I thought we were in for another one because both teams have goals in them, but obviously not in this game. It was a dull affair. Cerezo were the better team. They're almost their best chance, I say a chance, but Marahashi had a shot from well inside his own half that almost caught Slovic out. He wasn't far away, so that would have been quite clearly goal of the season if it just dropped a yard or two the other side of the post. But yeah, they kept going. Taggart had a little bit of a battle with Slovic with a couple of headers that Slovic did well to save. But, I mean, the best chance of the game probably fell to Vegalta Sendai in the 90th minute, where Kim saved from Uehara's shot at the edge of the area. Nishimura followed in. He was pretty much alone. He probably should have scored, but he hit the post, and it would have been an absolute smash and grab for Sendai if they'd managed to come away with the 3 points, but it wasn't to be, and it ends 0-0, and a result that really doesn't do either team too much favour. I mean, Cerezo are in a position a bit like Hiroshima, and they're kind of stuck in mid-table. They're maybe focusing on the ACL would be the way they go for the rest of this season, because they're not really going to get into the ACL places at all in the league, and I don't think they'll be sucked into a relegation battle, but I suppose you never know. And Sendai, they tease getting close to escaping the relegation places, but now there's a 5-point gap again. It's extended a bit more, so a little bit of worry for Sendai. A team that aren't really doing anything at the moment in the transfer window, when teams around them are, Shonan and Yokohama and Oita have all made a few transfers. So yeah, it's slightly worrying for Sendai, but they kept themselves in this game. They're always going to be a team that will cause teams problems. They're not going to lose too many like being battered, so they're still in it. But yeah, this is a disappointing general performance from them.
Yes, indeed. All right, so I think we'll leave it there. And indeed, that's all of the games from Match Day 23 rounded up. So what lies ahead in J1 in the coming week? Well, thank you for asking. Yokohama F. Marinos and Nagoya face off in their game in hand at Mitsuzawa on Thursday night. That's a second hosting sixth in the table. And then Shimizu and Gunma Osaka kick off the Match Day 24 slate with a clash at Nihon Daira on Friday night. Then we have five games on Saturday with another lunchtime kickoff at the Sapporo Dome that I'm sure you're looking forward to, Sam. FC Tokyo travelling up to face Consadole, and the remaining four games on Sunday. So I bet Sapporo FC Tokyo at whatever o'clock it is for you isn't your pick of the weekend. So what game are you plumping for a neutral to watch over the course of this J1 match day?
Yeah, it's an interesting set of fixtures. There's a few that I could pick out. It might not be a popular decision, this one, but I'm going to go with a relegation six-pointer, Vigalta Stenda against Yokohama FC, just because of the way Yokohama performed this on Monday. Is it just a flash in the pan, or do they become like a real deal? And it's a game must-win for both teams. Sendai would have ordinarily looked at this fixture as an absolute must-win if they're to get out of the relegation places. And a win for Yokohama puts them right in contention. So, yeah, I'm going to go for that one. It may not be the most glamorous, but although Yusuke Matsue will probably try his best in that regard. So, yeah, let's go for Sendai Yokohama is probably my pick of the weekend. This is the most important game.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I don't mind it. And it's probably the only time this season until we get right down to the nitty-gritty that you're going to be mentioning either of those teams, I reckon, Sam. So, yeah, when it's an important game like that, and, yeah, Yokohama FC look like they've thrown the gauntlet down on Monday night. Let's see if they can continue it against, arguably the league's top keeper. So it'll be, it should be a really interesting game, that, at 7 o'clock Saturday night up at the Yurtec Stadium. There are quite a few intriguing fixtures, aren't there? I guess most of them come on the Saturday around the same time. So, other listeners who support some of these other teams will obviously have their eyes on other fixtures. For example, Reds, you wonder how many of their new signings might be ready to go when they hosted Tosu, who are obviously down to the bare bones. But, yeah, their system is working so well for them, and they're very capable of giving anybody a game, as obviously they sit third in the table. And then, as we expect, Leandro Damião is absent from the Kawasaki side when they visit Kashiwa Reysol. Are Reysol going to be able to take advantage and, build on the momentum of Monday night's late winner at Kobe? I mean, there's obviously Kobe could have some of their new players as well when they visit Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. So they could be making things very uncomfortable for Graham Freche if some of their new signing. I can't imagine they'd be ready to go, at least from the start, but you never know, I suppose. So, yeah, there are quite a few interesting looking games on paper, aren't there?
Oh, definitely. And Kobe, yeah, it'd be interesting because I think Osaka and Muto have both played in pre-season. So they've had a full pre-season with their team. So they should be there or thereabouts. They're both in the country. So I'd expect to see both of them at some stage in that game. And Bojan won't make it. So, yeah, that's going to be maybe a slight nightmare for Hiroshima. And that Reysol Frontale game, as you said, should be very exciting. Reysol looked good against Kobe. They've got the players that can hurt a Frontale team that won't be at their strongest. I mean, I thought we didn't really get into it, but Pedro Raul, Cristiano and Muto, they really combine nicely on the counter-attack. So they're definitely going to cause problems. So yeah, very exciting looking Saturday. And then into Sunday, I'd probably say Kashima versus Tokushima would maybe be my pick, especially if Tokushima can continue to play in the manner they did against Gamba. They could cause Kashima a few problems, and Kashima are a little bit of a hit and miss team. You never know which version is going to appear, so it could be a decent chance for Fortis to get another 3 points and try and get themselves a little bit of a gap to the relegation places. But yeah, on paper, I think it looks a really exciting weekend.
Indeed. I mean, yeah, we don't want to mention every single game, but yeah, I mean, for me, Nagoya hosting Shonan, obviously we'll be bringing back flashbacks again to Grand Freche and all the Grandpa supporters after, Shonan relegated them all those years ago. And they do have a good record away at Nagoya. Most of those games were usually played, of course, at the older Mizuho Stadium because Shonan weren't big ticket enough to get their game played at the Toyota Stadium. But that's not an option these days. So Belmari will be fronting up to face Grampus, who of course are smarting off a defeat from a relegation zone occupant, and yes, they're coming up against another one in match day 24. So loads of intriguing fixtures to come over the weekend, and of course that Yokohama Nagoya one on Thursday night is a big one in its own right. So Sam, we've battled on just the two of us again this week. Terrific to get your thoughts on all of the top flight teams with as we said, J1 back and banging, and look forward to reviewing it all again next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Look forward to it. It's great to be back. I think it was a really exciting round of fixture. It's only getting more and more important and more intriguing as the season goes on. So, it's great to have the league back, as exciting as the Olympics was.
Yeah, to a point. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah. All right, so that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Grant Freche, Nick and Daniel very much for their involvement on this week's episode. And we'd like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. Listeners, of course, it goes without saying that we'd also like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up all of the match day 24 action. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.